Again, I want to apologize to you if you came to church today expecting a sermon about how Christians can claim Christ while respecting the religious pluralism of the world we live in. That's an important sermon, and hopefully a good one I will give another day sometime soon. Today, I ask you to reach in with me into the gospel text and consider what it might mean to walk on water in today's world. I have shared with you before how much I enjoy stand-up paddleboarding. It's one of those activities I do that always brings me closer to Jesus and Peter walking on the water. I'll recall for you the first time I tried paddleboarding. I awkwardly crept from all fours to standing up. And once I got my balance, I thought, hey, this isn't so hard. This is easy. I glided along the water and couldn't help but imagine Jesus, locks flowing as he calmly sauntered up to the panicked disciples in their boat, battered by the waves in an upset sea. Cool, I thought, as I stood perpendicular to the water, and wondered if Jesus felt the same sensations when he too stood on the sea, which was really a lake, the Sea of Galilee. Then I made it across the harbor, and it was time to turn my paddleboard around. I had barely turned 180 degrees when a wave smashed against my paddleboard. My gut clenched, my arms and legs were flying akimbo, and I had the grace of a giraffe in a bouncy house as I regained my balance on board. And just as I found equilibrium again, kerplunk, another wave had smashed against the board, and I and my sun-drenched body was soaking wet. My Jesus-dreaming ego was dunked into the icy waters. I was not Jesus. I was more of the sinking disciple, Peter, humbled by my mortal limits. The current heading back to shore was completely different and much more disagreeable than the current leaving the beach had been. But I had to make it back to the beach where I had rented my paddleboard. So I braved the choppy waves and icy water, and I was dunked a few more times before my feet could actually wade onto the more trustworthy shore. Being a disciple of Jesus Christ can be smooth sailing much of the time. When we are in a country that still favors Christianity as a dominant religion, being a disciple of Jesus Christ can feel like smooth sailing. When everyone agrees in our household to come to church without rolling their eyes, groaning, or stamping their feet, being a disciple of Jesus Christ can feel like smooth sailing. When what happens in our culture seems to match what our church teaches, being a disciple of Jesus Christ can feel like smooth sailing. But let me suggest that if being a Christian always feels like smooth sailing, perhaps we are not truly being disciples of Jesus Christ. Perhaps we are not venturing out like Peter did onto choppy waters to go where Jesus has gone. Not fair, you may say to me, just like Kai did. All those other disciples were still in the boat. They didn't try to walk on water, but they were still considered followers of Jesus. True. But they were also venturing out onto stormy waters, battered by the waves and the wind, because they were in the boat Jesus had instructed them to take to the other side of the sea. They were doing as Jesus had asked of them. Right now, there are some very choppy waters in this country that are also rippling out across the world. As Christians, we cannot stay safely on shore. We are in a time when the church needs to exercise moral leadership. The posturing toward violence toward North Korea last week then culminating in the violence by white supremacists in Charlottesville over the weekend, require that Christians stand up for the gospel Jesus gave us. Jesus gave us some direction on how we treat our neighbor that we cannot ignore if we are to be his disciples. Today's climate asks that we go a little beyond being friendly and fair people to those around us. Today's climate demands that we step out into some frightening and choppy waters as we follow to where Jesus stands and tells us, come. Less than 1 week after we remember the anniversary of the human devastation that happened after the U.S. dropped a nuclear bomb on Hiroshima, the U.S. president threatened North Korea with fire, fury, and frankly power the likes of which this world has never seen before. Never seen? Is the president threatening something worse than the atomic bomb over Hiroshima? And he continued his posturing throughout the week on Twitter, one unstable world leader taunting another unstable world leader. I was in a daze over the week, wondering why there was not more outrage. And then I was at the beauty store in Leonia to buy more hair products, and I heard a neighbor share jubilantly to the shopkeeper his optimism about our country's direction. He said, "The economy is doing great, and our president is finally going to take care of North Korea and nuke them off the map." Ordinary people, ordinary neighbors, getting excited about the prospects of nuclear war. What is going on here? You don't have to go to Charlottesville to see extremism in this country. It has been resting calmly, even in our own neighborhoods, and now is only being noticed because our political climate has made it more socially acceptable for extremists to take their place in the public square. Perhaps the president was right about something when he said there is hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. I bristled when I first heard him say that. Was this like blaming the Nazi resistors alongside the Nazis for violence in World War II? Why did he not outwardly condemn white supremacists for the violence they committed and instigated in Charlottesville, Virginia yesterday? Why did this president, who was so quick to point the finger at Islamic terrorism, not use the word radical white terrorists? But it is easy to look at neo-Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan members and skinheads and say, they are evil. What they are doing is not normal or acceptable. And I'm not anything like that. What is harder to do and see and name are the smaller, more ordinary acts of racism we see and sometimes commit every day. Jesus warned the Pharisee not to point out the speck in his neighbor's eye without first addressing the log in his own eye. I'm currently reading this book called Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race by Debbie Irving. And if anyone would like to join me in reading it, please do. In fact, the Presbyterian Church, at the request of the co-moderators of our General Assembly, has published a study guide to go along with it, and it's written in Spanish and in Korean as well. One of the important things this book does is to look at whiteness as a culture, whiteness as a race, not simply as the default norm against which all other cultures are defined and evaluated. When I was in Atlanta recently, I found out that my cousin and his wife had moved from their outer ring Atlanta suburb to an almost exact replica of their house but 20 miles even further from Atlanta. Knowing that Thanksgiving would now be a 40-mile drive from my sister's home in the city center, I asked them why they decided to move so far. They told me, "Well, within just a few years, our neighborhood has transitioned to almost all Indian, and our children did not have anyone to play with anymore." I could not believe what had just been said. "What, do Indian children not like to play?" I asked sarcastically to my cousin and his wife. "Actually," Christine said, "it's really been hard because their children come home from school and the expectation is that they help around the house and study, no time for play." I let her remark go. After all, we were spending time together because it was my uncle's funeral. "But I know for a fact that Indian children make excellent play dates. My daughter always has a grand time playing with her Indian friends she made at school, and they imagine the most remarkable things when they play pretend together." I suspect my cousin's anxiety about her changing neighborhood is common among white Americans. In extreme form, these white Americans take to the street and scream things like, "Blood and soil, we will not be replaced." But what we think of as ordinary white Americans have a more subtle response. To them, instead of being willing to go against the current and test strange and new waters, they cling to their boats and even paddle to the opposite direction rather than experience what might happen out at sea. In avoiding stepping out of the boat, they may in fact miss the chance to be part of what Jesus Christ is doing in calling people of different cultures to each step out of their boats and test the waters of friendship, test the waters of community. Sure, there will be some cultural differences, and sometimes those can be difficult. There may even be moments of panic, sinking. But if we can get to the point where we can break bread or break naan or maybe share a bowl of rice together in each other's homes, we can, in fact, discover God in one another. I am convinced of this. What fascinates me about the gospel story is that Jesus is not the only one to walk on water. Peter joins him, even though he had never done it before. We can assume, even though he was clearly terrified, he stepped right out there to meet Jesus, even though he was the only one who did it. It's what we call in the Reformed tradition the priesthood of all believers. There's no reason why each and every one of us Christians cannot try to step out onto the stormy waters while trying to follow Jesus. This kind of bold faith does not have to be outsourced to pastors and theologians. Each believer can try walking on the water toward Jesus. I want to encourage you to try and walk on water yourselves. We can try it together when the current on the water is calm, here in this room where we feel somewhat safe with one another. Many have been moved by the Christian witness of pastors in Charlottesville, as well as the witness of other faith leaders who join hands together in solidarity, singing "This Little Light of Mine," making a boundary of love in the face of white supremacist demonstrators yesterday in Charlottesville. But you do not have to be clergy to exercise Christian moral leadership. I would like to invite us to take a time of silence for about 5 minutes or so. And in that time of silence, I ask you to reflect on where Jesus calls you to come. Take a step. Walk on water. Walk toward him. If anyone feels called by a still small voice or by the light of Christ inside of you, you may want to speak a few words, but you don't have to. If it ends up being 5 minutes of silence, that's 5 minutes well spent. But perhaps using your voice here will strengthen your courage to speak, also in wilder and choppier waters, offering moral leadership where it is sorely needed. When our time of silence is up, I will lead us in singing a verse of This Little Light of Mine.